Welcome to the Lighthouse Church podcast. Thanks so much for joining us for this week's message. We want to say a special thank you to each and every person that gives and partners with us. To learn more about what Lighthouse Church is doing in San Bruno and across the San Francisco Bay Area, visit our website, www.lighthousesanbruno.com. Like and subscribe so you don't miss any new content. Now, check out this week's message.
So you get the B team today. I'm going to try to continue in Pastor Allison's series on promises. And you can consider this one today titled, Never Alone. And what we're going to do is go into, if you want to bring your Bibles out, Mark 35 through 41. And I'm going to read from the English Standard Version, so that we don't have to deal with any old English words or anything like that. And it says, "On that day, when evening had come, he said to them, 'Let us go across to the other side.' And leaving the crowd, they took him with them in the boat just as he was, and other boats were with him. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves were breaking onto the boat, so that the boat was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they woke him and said, 'Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?' And he awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, 'Peace, be still.' And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. And he said to them, 'Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith?' And they were filled with great fear and said to one another, 'Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?'" These are seven short verses that make up this story. And if you're speed reading through the Bible to try to say, I want to get my Gospels or New Testament down, it's pretty easy to just gloss over this story, because just ahead of it, we have Jesus' first use of parables, and he has some pretty good ones in there in Mark 4. And right behind us in Mark 5, when he gets to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, we are actually having him confront demonically possessed people. So these are some fantastic stories that are out there. And it's like, okay, so there was a storm while he was on the way. I got it. let's move on. But I will point out to you that this story is repeated in Luke 8, and this story is again repeated in Matthew 8. So there are a lot of stories that appear once in the Gospels. There are still a decent number of stories that will appear in two of the three Gospels. You start to get to a rare amount of stories that have made it all the way into three of the four Gospels, virtually the exact same story. So God has to be telling us something. I think we need to slow down here and then try to dissect these seven simple verses and wonder, is there something deeper we should understand? So let's set the table. In the beginning, with the first few verses, we see that we're on the Sea of Galilee. And for those that know what that is, so I'm going to take their word for it, where he starts and where he ends going into Mark 5, we're talking about a 5-mile journey. So to give us some perspective, if this is the Sea of Galilee, starting right here in this auditorium, he's maybe sailing down to about where Genentech is in South San Francisco. So it's not a huge trip. The Sea of Galilee is also, from what the experts tell me, is 680 feet below sea level. And hills or mountains, depending on who you want to use for how big a word it is, ring the Sea of Galilee. And between the temperature changes and the winds, it's possible for storms, and they do happen, to just all of a sudden appear, and they're pretty heavy storms. But one thing I want to point out is that with the apostles, a number of them were fishermen from the Sea of Galilee. So they know this sea. They're seasoned veterans for what's going on. And as we saw in some of the subsequent verses, they're terrified of this storm. I mean, this is not some average, normal day storm that is hitting them. They must have never seen anything that's like this. So by the time we get to verse 37, and it says that a great windstorm had arose, and the waves were breaking into the boat, and the boat was already filling. We don't know, because the Bible doesn't tell us, whether this is just some garden variety heavy-duty storm that has occurred, or whether or not it's satanic, because he is on his way to go deal with some demons on the other side of the lake. But I'm going to submit to you that it doesn't really matter which of those two that we're dealing with. Because as Christ's followers, you have to be prepared for storms that are going to surely come in your life. It doesn't matter if it's satanic, and it doesn't matter if it's natural. So let's get to the meat of this story, which I find quite amusing, I guess in a sick way, because there's Jesus at the stern of the ship, that's the back of the boat, and he's asleep on a cushion. I would kind of submit to you that with a storm that's terrifying the fishermen that are apostles, and he's asleep, that all by itself could be a miracle, wondering how he's sleeping through this thing. But he is. And they wake him up. The verses say, "Teacher, do you not care we are perishing?" What they might as well be saying, if this was modern day times, "Hey dude, what in the world's going on? Don't you see how big a trouble that we're in? I mean, we're about to die here. And you're asleep. We need you right now in our lives." I'm wondering how many times, because I'm guilty of this, where I have the feeling that Jesus is just not listening to me. I mean, I think if we're all honest, that we're all confronted with these type of situations. The storm is hitting, the water is filling up in the boat, and I know there have been times in my life, Karen's been with me so she can attest to it, where we are just about certain we're about to sink, that somehow this just isn't going to work whatsoever. But somehow we didn't sink, and he never let us go down, which is a miracle in and of itself. I've been close to it. I've seen the ship fill full of water, but the Lord has actually always been faithful. So I'm going to pose my first question to you. How far are you willing to trust the Lord? How far before you just decide you're going to jump ship? Then in verse 39, he awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. Then we get to quite an interesting conversation, because he then turns after rebuking the wind. And you can say that he's basically rebuking the apostles, because he says to them, "Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith?" Which I find is an interesting word choice for what he's put in. Don't you know that just working with these disciples must have been, I'm going to use my words, this probably isn't accurate to how God works, but those disciples must have been quite difficult for Jesus. I mean, there he is, always explaining things to them. He's always giving them lessons. He's always trying to elicit their faith. And then somehow it just doesn't work. They just aren't getting it. They're not sure what in the world is going on. And this continues because well past this, all the way up to the point that we're getting to Jesus's crucifixion, they're still not getting it, really, when you get down to it. I mean, on the road to Emmaus, he says in Luke 24, "O foolish ones, and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken." They just can't wrap their mind around the fact that the Messiah is going to die. I mean, it's part of what the plan is, and they still don't get it. So, I mean, Jesus is being confronted with this, whatever we want to call it, all the time. I think the words that are in this text are the best, and that is, why are you so afraid? You still have no faith. You don't know what God's plan is going to be. I imagine that working with those disciples would be as discouraging as working with you or working with me. I mean, it's just, I just love the fact that he has that much patience and love for us. I wonder how many times Jesus has shaken his own head at me and said, "When are you going to get it?" And he must be doing that with the disciples here right now in this story. When are you going to get it? When are you going to understand? How is it that you have no faith? How is it that you're panicking in this storm? And every time we're facing those situations, when we're panicking, I know, at least from what I see, we cry out to the Lord sometimes. And we say something like, "Wake up, Lord, look at what's happening to me." In our lives, he's taking care of those situations. But then I think he kind of is coming back and then saying, "Hey, what's your problem? I got this handled. It's all part of my plan." We might not like what some of these transitions are and how some of them turn out. But I can attest that, at least in our lives, he's always taken care of us. And I think as further evidence of Jesus just saying, when are these people going to get it? I even note that in Luke, it's expressed in one of the parables when it says, when the Son of Man comes again, which will be in the second coming, obviously, here, will he find faith on the earth? I mean, will he? It's really up to us as to whether or not he's going to find that. Then this story again finishes in verse 41. Because they were filled with great fear. Now, this great fear they're feeling now in verse 41 is different than the fear they were feeling just two verses ago. That fear was, the ship is going down, we're sinking, we're going to die, don't you care? Here, they've now seen Jesus calm the waters, rebuke the storm, and it says, interestingly, they were filled with great fear. This is the type of fear of an awe where you know, I don't get it. I have fallen short of what in the world Jesus is trying to get us to learn. The disciples lived with Jesus, but they underestimated him. They didn't see that his power applied to their very own situation. Don't we even do this today? Where you get a diagnosis of something bad that happens to someone in your family, your immediate thoughts are to the doctors, to the health care, to the diagnosis, to the nurses, to the medicine. We forget the Lord should be what's first. We find that life is crumbling down around us. We don't have a job now. We're wondering what in the world's going to happen. How are we going to go for? And we're concentrating on everything we do, how we can get out of the situation. At some point, if you're like me, you remember, oh yeah, I've got to pray. I've got to remember that the Lord has my back. But sadly, even in my own life, I wish that was the very first thought that I had, and it isn't always the case. So we should not underestimate his power to handle crises in our lives. The disciples, it says, go on to say, who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him? They might as well basically be saying, what manner of man is this? And the answer is, of course, he's the Son of God. He is God incarnate. And that can only remind me of the words we should all think about often. And that is, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things are made, and without him nothing was made that has been made. And in him was life, and that life was the light of men. That light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. That's who that is. Now we might say to ourselves, because I always talk to myself this way, so I'll just throw it out there. We might say to ourselves, that's a nice story, but it happened 2,000 years ago, and Jesus was physically in the boat with them. And when I look around, Jesus is not in a boat with me. He's not on a hammock in the backyard. He's not sleeping in a room, empty room inside the house or anything like that. So, yes, there are some things to learn from the story, but, you know, does it really apply to my life today? So, I'm going to hit you with a story. And I know this story is true because I witnessed it. So that's why I'll be able to call this up. And this story has weird familiarity with Mark 4 of what we've been talking about here. And so what I'm going to do is go back last week to when Pastor Allison was telling us techniques and reasons why we should stop and listen to the voice of God. If any of you missed it or didn't quite catch it, you should listen to the podcast and re-go through it. Because in my life, when I really decided to up myself in terms of being a good and faithful servant, and I wanted to hear his voice, I said to him, I will do whatever you tell me, no matter how difficult it is. But I have one condition. And so this was my pleading with the Lord. I said, in that one condition, I know what my weakness is, and that is I can easily substitute how I think your plan should go as to what you actually want done. So my condition is, when you tell me something, I'll do it, but you better make it clear, bonehead clear, so it gets through this thick skull, so I understand what in the world you want me to do. And on one day, Karen, my wife, can attest to this, I knew that I had heard his voice, and he said, I want you to go to Haiti. Now, if you knew me, especially then, and you ranked all the things I could possibly do, going to Haiti is like at the bottom. It's not on my list of anything I want to do. But I heard his voice, and I knew I should do it. And this is not just your normal mission trip that I was on. It is not one where you go to a nice church in a foreign country and, you know, work with the kids and have some arts and crafts, try to introduce Jesus to them, and then come back to the United States. Now, this is one where even the church itself would say, no. I mean, they didn't say this to me, but to a lot of people, they'd say, no, you're not going. This is a church where you go not to Port-au-Prince, but you go into the interior of Haiti, and you're going to build a church. You're going to be in the middle of nowhere. There's practically no law. About the only thing that passes for law is maybe a United Nations security compound that's many miles away. You don't even know how you'd get a message to them if you were in trouble. And that's the mission I want you to go on. So we do it. And over the years, we actually managed to roll back voodoo as the predominant religion of the area and made Christianity the predominant religion of the area, which I consider quite miraculous. But on this one trip, I'm out, let's see if I can set this. This is my Sea of Galilee portion of the story. We're out in a plateau in the middle of the island next to hardly any people, I should say. The church is taking shape after a week and a half-ish or so, and then we all stop because it's getting darker, and it's getting, after sweating all day building this stuff, it's getting a little bit colder. And we look, or at least I should say I look, and there's a storm. Cue the storm, because this is Mark 4. Storm starts to come in off of the Atlantic, and it's, well, it's not a hurricane, so I won't say it's like the worst storm in the world, but it's a bad one. And it's one where my mind immediately races to saying, oh no, there's no roads out here. I mean, I can't tell you how many dry creeks we drove over in the truck and how many hills we had to get past. And then now this place is going to be wind blown and flooded. I don't even know how we're going to get out back to our own compound. That's what I'm thinking. So I'm worse than the apostles in this story. Other people doing the mission with me, at least they're a little better than me, but they're failing just like the apostles, because in their mind, they're saying, not just in their mind, they're actually saying to me, well, that storm is strong enough and wet enough, and the winds are obviously blowing enough, that the time it's hitting this church that we're building is so critical that it's basically going to destroy this mission. Because when you're out in the middle of Haiti, and all of a sudden you either don't have tools, you don't have the material, or something happens, there's no Home Depot that you're going to, just down the side. It takes them about 9 months to pre-stage and plan what needs to be done in order to do these projects. This storm is going to destroy it. So we physically will be okay when we finally find a way to get out of the mud, I guess, and everything. But this mission is going to be a failure. That last church won't be built. Fortunately, the person in charge of this mission, which I now look back and say is much wiser and better than we are, said, now we're going to all get together, every one of us, no exceptions, communal prayer, and I've never heard a group of men pray like what happened then. And everybody had to pray. And everybody tried to rebuke this wind. And the strangest thing happened at the end of this prayer. It might sound like I'm making this up, but I saw this. I looked at the storm as it was coming. Half of it went to the north of us on the left. Half of it went to the south of us on the right. The church itself, although it was hit with a little bit of the storm, it was nothing. Somehow, the rest of Haiti was devastated around us, but not where we were. So in other words, we called upon the name of the Lord. He wasn't there asleep. He rebuked the storm. We finished that mission. So, who is this then, that even the storm parts and spares our mission? I will remind you to go back and read John 1 again. So the biggest takeaway, I think, from this story, and I'm going to conclude with this, isn't that Jesus can calm the storm. It's that we, even today, are never alone. That we have to understand that he needs to be the cornerstone of our life. So next week, fortunately, the A-team will be back. And I hope to see you all again. Thank you.